retired professor of physics, December 8th, 88. The questions were developed by a group of people, our friends of yours, Cliff Schwartz, Francis Bonner, Sid Gilbert, and Tom Irvine.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a long list of questions. They cut it down. So let's go through these first. They're fairly quick, and you just let me run through. Have your name, department, and position.
David Fox, physics department, professor. I came to Stony Brook to Oyster Bay in 1959, and I was 39 years old at the time. I came from the University of Rochester as an assistant professor in the Institute of Optics with a secondary appointment in the Department of Physics. I was advised about the opening of Stony Brook by a physicist at Syracuse, Peter, do you need his name? It's a well-known name, that's why I feel silly about it. It just slipped my mind.
Where is he now?
I've lost track of him. He's probably retired by now. He's a general relativist and a rather well-known one. He knew Leonard Eisenbud.
I see.
And I've heard from Leonard about Oyster Bay and Stony Brook. Who interviewed me I came to Oyster Bay and gave a talk. The physics department consisted of three people at that time, so they gathered up an audience from what later became the science and mathematics division. And I was interviewed by Leonard Eisenbud. And I also talked to a lot of the other people in that division, particularly Francis Bonner.
I see. Did you talk to Olson by any chance?
I must have, but I just don't remember the interview. It was, after all, almost 30 years ago.
Right.
Why did I come?
What factors were important?
Well, I had had in my youth some political, left-wing political connections, which in the McCarthy days made me persona non grata at many universities, and I had great difficulty in finding jobs in those days. Although, of course, those incidents were long past, the McCarthyists were not forgiving. Other factor was that although I had a position at the University of Rochester, it was on soft money, and there were four people ahead of me in line for tenure, and the likelihood of getting only one tenure position on that, among all that soft money in the Institute of Optics for the next several years. So they said, stay as long as you like, and in the meantime, look for a tenure job if you want it. My understanding, that's number seven, my understanding was that the Stony Brook was developed to be, as is only half jokingly put then, to be the Berkeley of the East.
That phrase was that old, was it? It was being used in 59?
I don't really remember. Certainly it was used during the Oyster Bay days. But it represented my understanding, even though that particular phrase may not have been used. That is, that the East, the Northeast at least, had at the time no really very good state universities, I mean totally state universities as opposed to private universities with state money. And been to the University of California for many years as an undergraduate and a graduate student, what a good state university could be like.
Where were you as an undergraduate?
At Berkeley, as a graduate student.
I see. So your PhD is from Berkeley?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So I was looking forward to having New York State having a first-rate institution. What was the vision being transformed? I'm not sure I understand the...
All I'm saying is really a repetition of seven.
Uh-huh.
In other words, what was the purpose behind the establishment of Stony Brook, as you understood it.
Yeah, have I answered sufficiently, or did you want more detail? I don't know what.
I don't think there was a master plan then.
No, but individuals spoke to me of what they considered to be the purpose. As I later found out, there's a good deal of disagreement among the faculty members who were then there.
Yes.
You surely have heard all this.
Yes.
And I had originally spoken, when I came down there, of course, to the science people who had a particular view of what it should be and what their expectations were. And only later, after that's on the time I came down for the interview, which was in the spring of 59. And after I came in September, of course, I learned about the split of the faculty.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. Up to eight now?
Eight, right.
Well, and of course, every time it says Stony Brook, I'm interpreting this at least in reference
right.
to the early
years
as
Oyster Bay.
It was a very exciting place. There was a lot of vision of the future, very stimulating as a result. I liked the idea of building something. People were involved, they were deeply involved. On the other hand, of course, I was unhappy about the intensity of the split. I mean, I think it's perfectly right to have a variety of opinions, but I thought, perhaps not at first, but as things developed, that the split raised the danger of almost destroying the institution. Opinions were so violent. As it turned out, after we moved to Stony Brook, that died out, that part of it, and we were still in exciting days, which you surely remember. That was when you came.
Right.
I thought the top leadership was a little weak, but that was more than made up for by the fact that this is a nice debate.
Yeah.
By the fact that the there were so many builders among the faculty members that made up for it.
Yeah.
It meant, of course, that there were two distinct thrusts in different directions. But it was
that must have taken quite a lot of energy on the part of some people away from. Away from either their teaching or their research for a while.
Yes, well, most of the original people in physics later, let's say the first seven people of those only one still active in research.
Who's that?
Hi. But not very intensely, very low level. One died, that's Jim Rouse.
Yes.
And, see, one, two, three, well, make sure I've got everybody, four, five. One has been active, I'm talking about research in physics.
Yes.
One has been active in, also a low level, in research using physics in another field.
Who
is that? Herb Meether, who's been examining first paintings and then old manuscripts. So he's doing it as a physicist, but of course the purpose is,
it's applied physics, isn't
it? Yeah, well, it's applied physics in a sense, but there are different definitions of applied physics. This is even one step removed from what most physicists call applied physics, in that it's using the physics techniques in an entirely different field. I think that if a doctor uses an X-ray machine, that it's not applied. He may call it applied physics, but it's not really. It doesn't. The applied physicists would be people who developed. In that sense, Herb was an applied physicist in that he developed a technique. But once it's developed, you see, then it's art, you see. Or medicine in the case of the X-rays.
Right.
And most of this is because once you, when you work so hard on essentially administrative things, I'm using administrative in the broadest sense, down to down to the individual faculty members' involvement in administration. Well, as you work on that for such a long time, you're away from your field.
Yes.
You haven't read very much, and it's so hard to catch up.
That's right.
That is true. The people who came a little later, that is, in the last year of Stony Brook, who are they? One, two, three, I can remember. I don't remember four of them, I think, but I don't remember the fourth one was. Are still active in research, but not the people who came in the first 3 years, I mean, except in a very limited way. Oh, and also Cliff is very active, but no longer in physics research.
I think it was great that he got the Oersted Medal.
That was well deserved.
Yes.
Let's see.
You said that you thought the leadership was a bit weak. What individuals did you have in mind? On the campus or in Albany?
Oh, I think the Albany leadership at that time was nothing, really. It was only later, a few years later. I think, remember, I had very little contact with Albany in those years. I had very indirect and vague impressions. So I don't mean this statement to be anything more than an impression, that until Sam Gould came, there was nobody who had a really proper vision of the university.
Not even Porter or Tom Hamilton?
That's right. I'd forgotten about Hamilton. I'd completely forgotten about Hamilton. He may have, but he wasn't there very long, was he? You're straightening me out now on my memory of this time, and I better withdraw.
Hamilton resigned December 31st of 62.
So he's only there for about 2 or 3 years.
Well, a little more than that, but how long, I don't know. I don't know when he came.
Yeah, it may have started with Hamilton rather than with, that's true. And he brought in a lot of new people. But no, I meant the leadership on campus.
Yeah.
I think that Olson certainly was could be the head of a kind of institution he thought of, a small liberal arts college with the orientation that he believed in.
Is it Olson?
But he didn't have the vision of university, nor did he have a feeling for a university. A university president, even if he comes from a particular field, has to have some sense of the needs of all fields. It's something that I learned even as graduate dean. You know, in the first few months, I learned how different the needs of an English department were from those of a physics department.
Right.
And he had absolutely zero feeling for the needs of the sciences. Yeah. Now, I don't know about the social sciences. I have no idea. But certainly the sciences, he had no feeling whatsoever. I mean,
being a dean,
complete misconception.
Being a dean is a liberal education in itself.
Well, but even as late as the time that he left, he made statements that made it clear. The one thing that saved the situation is that he knew that he didn't know. And so he deferred to people like Francis and Leonard in their opinions. But what he really wanted was very different from what they did. And some of those experiments, I'm not an expert on general pedagogy, but things like the St. John's experiment, no longer an experiment, or Hampshire College, may be fine for the liberal arts, but I see the products in the sciences, and the only time they're successful is with students who could have learned that without ever going to college, a kind of independent student who's going to study no matter what will be successful there. But they learn really, I mean, it's really great for teaching the history of science and the philosophy of science, which are very important. But it's terrible preparation for graduate school. It's no preparation at all for industry, which is all right. I mean, you know, not every university has to prepare for industry.
No.
But it's no preparation to be a physicist. It's preparation for a person who wants to think about physics or who wants to go into an allied subject like for history or philosophy, sociology of science, or something like that. The kind of thing that Olson wanted to do would have meant really giving up the idea of physics as a research subject, giving up, in fact, I think we've been disastrous with teaching physics. There's some idea, for example, at the very beginning that every having unity in all subjects. Now, I'm all for that. I mean, I'd like to point out to my students the connection between this and that. I mean, that synthesizing is a very important aspect. But sometimes you have to look at the details, and what is the connection between a neutron and Shakespeare? And they were going to search for that. I'm exaggerating, of course.
Yeah.
But not terribly much exaggerating, because there's one course that was designed to cover everything. So anyway, that gets too much into my opinion as a partisan on that side. But the net result of this all, you see, is that the administration there, they're running a school which originally, by the way, was designated a science college, which none of us wanted, and even the scientists didn't want.
Right.
They went to the university.
Okay.
And they ran the science college in such a way that, they didn't run it because of this deferring to Francis and Leonard, and probably to the, who was chairman of biology, probably Frank Dirk, you know. But it would not have, the science program, had they had their way, the science program would have failed. Unless they want them to change it into the social science of science, you know, the philosophy and social science of science. So. Does that cover that?
Yeah, I think so. The spirit, you've indicated that people were excited about creating something.
Oh, yes. It was a very exciting times. And then it lasted into the 60s. And then the realities of running a large university on too small a budget, of course, began to make themselves felt. And it's hard to maintain that. I've been through this twice, by the way. In the 50s, the Israelis decided to take what's called the Technion, or the Israeli Institute of Technology, and change it from what was just sort of a minor, rather poor engineering school into, they also have this phrase, not the Berkeley of the East, but the MIT of the Middle East. Just rather amazing.
They had models, in other words.
Yeah. So before we called this the Berkeley of the East, they called it the MIT of the Middle East there. And I was hired by a man named Nathan Rosen, who was to be the chairman. He was still in the United States. And I went over there for 4 years. And that was an exciting time, too. The time of building. And this is the kind of thing I like.
Yeah.
But after a while, you know, when you're no longer building, that excitement has to die down.
Okay, nine.
Events, well, we're up to nine, yes. Events, persons, and experience that stand out of my mind.
Now, you don't have to stay in Oyster Bay.
I
want to go
sure. As
far as 71. You can go... You can go into the 3 years that I was running the place, and go into John Toll's early years.
Mm. Well, of course, my memory, I'm getting to a point where my memory is no longer clear on many things. That some of the things of my childhood are clearer to me than things that far back. I would say, in my own department, of course, the first, when we hired Max Dresden, that made a change. And then, of course, the enormous step of Frank Yang coming.
Yes.
I think a lot of this has to do with Alec Pond, that he's a man of a vision. He was a man who worked very hard to get things done, and he really built that department. Leonard has to get a lot of credit for starting it, but taking it past that initial stage was all Alec's doing. And I know that...
He came in September of 62.
That's right. He came when we moved here.
Yes, same time I did.
Yeah, right. When Frank was to come here, there was a time problem. That is, it would take some time to set up this what's it called, the Einstein Fellowship for him. But it had to be approved by Albany. There was a lot of paperwork and so forth. So he sought some funds, or he, meaning Alec, sought some funds so that he could bring Frank here a semester earlier. And he wrote to the New York State something, Institute for Science and Technology, not Institute. Some organization that's that name. I think it's one of these sort of semi-public groups that the state set up to bring science and technology to New York State. And he wrote this, I don't know, 50, 100-page proposal, whatever it was, telling the effect on the university, the effect on the Long Island economy, the effect on New York State, and the intellectual implications and everything. You know. And a few years later, I met the, president or the chairman or the chief executive officer of that institute.
Remember his name?
No, I don't. And he had nothing but privilege. He says, it's so far above and beyond the quality that is Alec's proposal. It's so great. I mean, he wished all the others were like that. He says, nothing came even near that. Well, I didn't meet the man again for 3 or 4 years. And again, this is about 6 or 7 years later, he was still enthusiastic about that proposal. It was really a marvelous thing. By the way, there's an interesting little story, just for your own sake, that I wanted to mention about how Frank, the whole business of Frank's coming here came up. Now, mind you, this is an institution at that time that was hardly known as the physics department. It was hardly known anymore. We did our recruiting by contacting friends because we weren't known generally. Alex and Max and I were having lunch one day, talking about the building of the department. And one of them said, "We have to get somebody really, absolutely first rate. And whom shall we get?" And one of them said, "How about Frank Young?" And you know the word chutzpah? You ever come across
it? Well, I have, yes.
Unmitigated gall.
Yeah.
The chutzpah that we had was represented by the fact that all of us nodded that, yes, that would be very good. As if, there's nothing institution, there's nothing physics department could hope to get a person like that. And then we got him.
That's before Toll's name had come up, or?
I think his name had come up, but nothing serious was being done yet.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it was just the beginning. There was a whole bunch of plans, and one of them, of course, was to see whom we could recommend for. There was a time of big recruiting, including a lot of administrative posts. And so the word went around, the search committees, I don't know if they had search committees in those days, but whoever it was wanted suggestions. And we said, whom should we suggest? And it was right around that same time that Toll's name came up. I don't mean at that lunch, but something of that sort. So anyway, that was a story. Just a little background story. Outside the department, at that point, well, of course, all the administrators, you and John Toll and Stan Ross, I remember well. I mean, what was being done, but in the faculties of the other departments, I began to lose touch with people, except as my job of dean necessitated. No, that wasn't true. While I was dean, I still had a lot of touch. No, that was wrong. While I was dean, I still had a great deal of involvement with the departments.
When were you made dean of the graduate school? Was that it?
Yeah, Arnie Feingold. Yeah, Arnie was appointed and then resigned when John Lee was dropped. And the word came from Albany that no new deans would be appointed. Now somebody had to do the job, and I happened to be chairman of the graduate council.
Yeah.
So for 1 year, actually from May, in the last couple of months in Oyster Bay, and then the whole following academic year here, I was chairman of the graduate council, but as such, ran the sort of budding graduate school. I think we had 25, the whole university had 25 graduate students at that time, so And at the end of the year, I think, my recollection is hazy, but it must have been that you asked me to be dean.
I think I did.
I was dean for three more years. I mean, for 3 years, in addition to that 1 year when I served out of time. And I remember I resigned three times. The reason for the three resignations was the following. I resigned. And we started to, just the very beginnings of a search, that is, just getting some names together. And then at that point, the John Toll thing came. And it was, discussed with some people and decided, you know, if he's going to come, let him be involved in the choice of the dean. It's not fair, you know, just before he comes. I mean, if he comes and there are people who are deans already, that's different. But if by serving one more year, I could allow him to be involved in the choice, I thought that would be useful. So I withdrew my resignation, and then I wrote a letter to John when he was appointed. And this was in early spring, it must have been 65, yes, or mid-spring, sometime the spring semester in any case. And I congratulated him on the appointment, and then I said, I'm resigning from the deanship. So that was my second resignation. He wrote back to me, he said, I can't think about this now. Could you serve another year? So I served another year and then resigned again. But for some reason, John at that point thought that I left for a sabbatical here, but I took a sabbatical that next semester. And John was under the impression I was coming back as dean. I don't know whether he'd forgotten that he resigned or just didn't believe me. So in a sense, I had to resign a fourth time, only this time just verbally, a verbal reaffirmation of the third resignation. Anyway, that's actually my own personal history, not so much Stony Brook's.
Well, that is reminiscent, really, of my position. I came, as you know, as acting chief administrative officer and dean of arts and sciences.
Yeah.
And for 1 year, until they could find a president.
And that's right. You were actually appointed to the position in Albany on leave to run this campus.
I was executive dean of the Albany office.
Right.
Do you remember the first time that I met the faculty? Were you one of those that met around the long table in Kuhl Hall when Harry Porter brought me in and introduced me to everybody?
Yeah, I remember you being introduced. I just don't remember anything else about that meeting.
How much did you know about me beforehand? Do you know anything?
I don't remember. I learned about your deanship at Bucknell, but I can't remember whether I learned about it before that meeting or at that meeting or after the meeting. I just don't know.
Right. It was a little bit amusing to me, but here I had been, I had been appointed dean of Cornell College only after I had sat with two of their major committees, and given my philosophy of education. This is when I was coming from Berkeley. Then at Bucknell, the president brought me in, and as far as I know, the faculty didn't know much about me at all. It was just superimposed on the faculty. And here again was another instance, and I wondered how much the faculty had a hand in selecting.
None. I know the system of that time, I can answer not because of my memory of your case, but because my knowing the system of the time. The faculty was generally not consulted. We discussed academic matters at great length and had great battles, you know, in faculty meetings. They were not consulted about things like appointments, deanships, and so forth. I remember, for example, that the equivalent, I think it was called a promotion and tenure committee at the time, or some phrase like that, had no right to criticize the choice to examine the qualifications of any faculty member being promoted or offered tenure or appointed. All they could do was say to report to Olson that the file was in order.
Absolutely.
They had no rights about that. That, I think, was changed about the time we moved to Stony Brook. I think you changed it.
Yes, well, you had some say about one or two of the people who were proposed by Harry Porter. You remember Oscar Lanford being proposed?
I remember the name.
He was proposed for president by Harry Porter.
Was that after he moved here?
After, yes.
After. Oh, yeah, no, that's after a change.
Yes.
Yeah, that's after a change.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
Right.
Because Harry had been president of Fredonia, and Oscar Lanford was then president of Fredonia. Harry brought him down as his idea of the kind of person who might be president of Stony Brook. And the, I think it was called the Graduate Council, that interviewed him and turned thumbs down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that. That I remember. But, no, when I said we had no say in any of these things, I was,
right.
At least certainly during the early years of this debate, and I think all the way up to the time we left, but I'm not absolutely
right.
Sure. And my impression, I don't remember, is that you made those changes.
It could very well be. I've forgotten.
Or you may not have made them yourself, but you may have designated, you may have, there may have been some faculty committee that you were asked to look into the question. There's a faculty governance committee of some kind, wasn't there? And the whole governance structure was changed, actually not all in one step, but you know, over the years. There's no real governance that was to pay, except in purely academic matters.
One thing I want to ask you about, the process by which we determined here on the Stony Brook campus which departments were ready to apply for graduate permission from Albany to get either an MA or a PhD program. Do you have any recollection?
Yes,
of that?
That I remember because we've been through it many times, and then I, the same system with modifications is used now. I don't know how this was done for physics, chemistry, and I think it was mechanics they called it at that time, which is not called mechanical engineering. Those three departments were the first three to have graduate
right.
programs. That was done under Arnie Feingold, and I have no idea how that was set up. When I took over, I think after we arrived in Stony Brook, I had known in other places that people bring in visiting committees,
sure.
So review committees, various things called. So I set up that system. Now, what amused me was that Harry Porter heard about this, and he spent a few minutes once when we were meeting there saying, that's a marvelous idea, I'll adopt it for the whole university, because he was sort of a graduate dean, I don't know, they didn't call it that, but they had a whole graduate program. And I started to say, but, you know, meaning to say, you know, I thought it was standard at other universities. And he was so enthusiastic, I could never get it out. And so I finally let it go, I think he continued to give me credit for this marvelous idea, which wasn't my idea at all. Anyway, I remember a few of the committees. I remember a committee for an engineering department. There was one for the English department.
There was a committee for biology.
There was a committee for biology, yes, yes.
There was a chap from Brown and a chap from, I think it was either MIT or Harvard, I forgot which. But I did the telephoning to bring them in.
Yeah.
And,
And
the matter of English, the people we brought in steered us away from applying for a PhD at the time.
Yeah. They gave us a set of shortcomings, and I discussed this, maybe we both discussed this with the English department, and the department promised to correct this, and by the time they applied again for the PhD, the new committee agreed with that.
So we were never turned down on any of our applications, as far as I know.
To my knowledge, that's correct. Not in those years, and I've not heard of any later. And I was active on the Graduate Council again for about 6 years, something like that, and there again, they were never turned down. This was in the 70s or early 80s, perhaps. Yeah, that was in the 80s. Well, maybe two periods. That's right. We did the turning down ourselves.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
And in the case of English, we didn't void the whole application. We accepted the master's program.
That's right. That's right.
And postponed the PhD consideration.
I brought in Bill Dix, who was the librarian at Princeton, to look over our collection.
I had forgotten that. Yes, I remember now. Right.
Yes.
Then there was a woman, retired.
Marjorie Nicholson.
That's it.
Marjorie Nicholson,
yes. Right. And she...
turned out she was the daughter of Dean Nicholson at Wesleyan when I was an undergraduate.
Uh-huh. I see.
I never knew that.
Remember I said something about learning about English departments, the needs and so forth. I also learned about differences of ways of judging people at that time. She made a statement, well, you don't have any really senior people here. Coming from the Department of Physics, where a 30-year-old man, if he's good enough, can become a senior person, you know, or if not, you know, 35 is probably more, you know, and here there are people in their 50s that she didn't consider senior. And I realized so, that in areas where criticism, and I'm using the scholar, really criticism is only a narrow part of it, where scholarly work is the most important, you have to build up an enormous background. Whereas in areas where creative activities are important, and this includes music, not music history, but something like music composition, or theoretical physics, things of this sort, it's the young people who do the exciting things, and the older people are important in their contribution to development and criticism and guidance, you see. So a young person can become very eminent. Look at Einstein, who was, did three really world-shaking pieces of work, three distinct ones, at the age of 26. He's only famous to the general public for one of those three. And didn't become eminent immediately. By the time he was 32, 33, of course, all these things were thoroughly recognized. So that was one thing. And the other thing was in the other direction, where some of the committee members from the humanities and some of the social sciences would say, how can you promote that man in physics or chemistry or whatever? He never wrote a book. And I had to explain to him that you write books in physics as a duty to the profession or to make money. Because books are totally unimportant. They're only texts. They're only collections of ideas. There's nothing new in a physics book, whereas in a history book, there's and that's it. That's nothing very, all your analysis goes into there. You may never have gone through an article. Couldn't understand it, so I finally gave up. Anyway, it was a marvelous education for me.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry for these little off.
They're really very important because a university is an institution, and an institution is a collection of individuals organized for certain purposes, and it's the purposes and the method of implementing them that counts, that really, really becomes the history of the institution.
Mm-hmm. Are we up to 11, or where are we, Tom?
I think so.
What expectation did you have when you come? Well, I sort of answered it, but in bits and pieces, so I'll just summarize. Expectations of a major university, which would be one of the leading universities in the country. And let me combine that with 12. The expectations worked out in a spotty sort of way, compared to the big state universities, we're fairly small, and that means also small in number of faculty members. I mean, it's a good-sized institution, but it's small compared to the Midwestern universities in California. And so we don't have the breadth that they have, perhaps, but within the areas that we do represent, we range from excellent to a few departments that I hear are still pretty poor. A number of world-famous departments, some other very
Can
good
ones. Can
you
be specific here on this?
Well,
your judgment.
The only one where I really have a right to judge is physics. And
yes.
I think you know about this. I think that but my understanding is that the music department is first rate. Several of the departments in the biological sciences, that is on both sides of the road, in the medical school as well as here, are world famous. The chemistry department is not up to the physics department, but does have some substantial standing. And the others I don't know too well. Some of the social sciences, I gathered one or two of the social science departments, but I really don't know there.
What about mathematics?
Mathematics, yes. In fact, that's the one where I can judge, and that's really very good.
It is very good. I say.
The rest of them, I just don't know.
Okay.
I understand that there's one language department that has some, but this is just all vague rumor to me, and I just don't know.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Were your activities confined to the Stony Brook campus? That's 13.
Yes. Well,
did you have relations outside?
Well, let's start with the central office in Albany. Of course, while I was dean, I had, whatever you expect. And not as much, perhaps, as you did, certainly. But in the areas I was involved, I have continuing relationships, mostly through Harry Porter.
Do you have any relations with Dave Price?
Minimal.
Yes.
Minimal.
Vice President for Personnel. He was a big help.
Yeah. He helped me on one occasion, but generally my work was, I was not involved much with personnel. I mean, beyond hiring secretaries, I really did not do anything else. Stan Ross would call me in to meet various people that were being considered for major positions in the faculty. And I would give my opinion, and that was the end. I mean, when that person was hired, somebody in Stan's office would follow the paperwork through. I had nothing to do with that. So Dave and I met on a number of occasions. For example, if I go up for a budget committee hearing, he'd, of course, be there. But as far as direct contact, I think there's only one occasion. On the other hand, I had extensive, quite a number of, times when I interacted with Harry Porter, which is,
What was your impression of Harry, and what was your impression of Stan Ross?
I think they're both good at their jobs, but I think both of them have limited vision. I think that is more true of Harry than of Stan. But I remember the number of times that Stan would say, well, this is the way we did it in Nebraska. My feeling is Nebraska, is a good university, but we should, even if we don't reach it, our goal should be the best university in the country. If you don't reach it, okay, you don't reach it. But if you set your goal at Nebraska, you'll wind up down below Nebraska, you see. And he could never see that. Otherwise, I thought he did a fine job for what he had to do, but he just didn't have it. Let me contrast it with Alec. Now, Alec had the problem that he didn't communicate properly with people in the humanities, let's say. He had these difficulties, but he was a man of great vision, enormous vision, and it always set the goal much higher than we'd eventually achieved. But by setting it that high, he get up higher than he would have
otherwise.
This was something that struck me in the building of the university, the contrast between the people, and there were a number of people like Alec. I think Alec is just the exceptional example among them. And the other people who always played low. One example, a department chairman was on leave during a year when the department asked for a graduate program. And the acting chairman asked for in the budget for 5 assistantships. Listen, Dave, remember, in those days, the money was relatively plentiful compared to what it is now. I mean, we have budgets much larger now, but I'm talking about the per capita budget, per faculty member, that is, or per student, for that matter. Rockefeller had been, you know, relatively generous with us. And the money was there. We could get it. And I said, why don't you ask for 10? He said, oh, they'll never give it to us. And I said, ask for it and see. And, of course, we got the 10. And I said, can you use 10? He says, well, where will we get the graduate students? I said, you'll go out and you'll recruit them. And, of course, when the chairman came back, he briefed me thoroughly and recruited. You know, he could have used 15 assistantships, you know, but anyway. This kind of thing, now, I'm talking only about this one thing. The people with the lower level of expectation were sometimes extremely good in